Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. Open your mind to a new way of living. timberliving.ie.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. I hope we don't all look back and go, remember that time we heard in the news that ChatGPT had, or that OpenAI had got rid of Sam Altman? We should have known then that the whole AI thing was turning bad. But look, hopefully not. But he was out engaging a lot on it and talking about how dangerous it potentially was for a guy who was selling it. Like, he was also saying, look, we need to be really responsible about what we do here. So look, I haven't read in properly to the reasons why he's gone, but I don't know. You just worry. Anyway, the front pages of the paper today, dominated obviously by the sentencing hearing and the very, very powerful victim impact statements yesterday from Aisling Murphy's family and from her boyfriend Ryan Casey. And you know, the headline on The Sun make you think of the what ifs that you could torment yourself with here. And Aisling Murphy's mother saying, I begged her not to go. She begged her not to go down the canal that day. And we can all relate to that. Which way are you going, or where are you, what way are you going to come home? And it shouldn't be the situation, but it kind of can be with our daughters and the women in our lives. The Irish Daily Mail has a quote from Ryan Casey. Because of you, I will never marry my soulmate. Tears and rage as Aisling's partner tells court to the love of his life. The Star, may you be in hell. And I think the rest of that quote from Ryan Casey was a half an hour before God knows you're dead. Take him away to hell is the headline on the Mirror. And then the Irish Examiner, dream daughter Aisling was one in a million. Also on the front of the Irish Examiner, in other news, their off lead is Backhurst understated pay by 31,500 in RTE interview. Ciara Phelan reporting that RTE Director General Kevin Backhurst underreported his total pay package by 31,500 this week after he got quotes mixed up. This was in a live interview on Prime Time on Tuesday. And the Irish Times are leading with hopes rise that last Irish citizens can leave Gaza, and I think there are families arriving into Dublin Airport within the next hour from Egypt, getting home finally. And then the Irish Independent, a bit of good news potentially, homeowners in line to save hundreds as interest rates tip to fall. So like, it does seem that in the last couple of months inflation has suddenly come back down to within range anyway of the 2% target. So they're suggesting that interest rates could start falling as early as the first quarter of next year. Some people say it'll be later next year. But anyway, we will put all that aside now, because we are going to talk about love now. And I'm joined by three people, I suppose, at different stages of the love journey. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Tom Inglis, you're a sociologist, and you've written a lot about love. You've written indeed about your own love life, but also, I suppose, about the sociology of love. Actress Clelia Murphy, you're just newlywed. Congratulations.
Correct. Thank you very much. I'm very smug right now.
Yeah, so presumably in love.
I have to stay in love for the next year. Yeah. And now okay. Make the perfect bed. I know how to cook turkey. It's amazing. I'm so smug. I advise for everybody. I should have done it sooner.
Mm. Okay. Did you go back to the 1950s when you got married?
Yeah? I did, yeah.
Okay, all right.
And I'm not apologising.
Okay. Yeah. And broadcaster and influencer James Patrice, you're kind of looking for love, but not desperate or anything.
I'm in the gutter, but the others are happy.
That's not true. Word is your wand.
It's good to have the bit of misery of the gutter, so it keeps you on your toes. But I would be not actively looking, but if it came along, Brandon, you wouldn't say no? That's my line.
Okay. Like, if you had to go back to the 1950s to find it, would you do that?
Well, I'd probably have to marry a woman. That wouldn't be great, would it?
That is so true. You're right.
Kind of okay. Maybe I have more luck, actually.
You're so right.
I'll start doing that.
Okay, so listen, before we get everyone's kind of own stories, and you all have very different and illuminating stories, Tom, give us the overview on love. I suppose romantic love in particular. Like, on one hand, people used to think this is the glue that holds the world and society and all of us together. On the other hand, an increasing view that romantic love is a kind of delusional madness.
Yes, it is. But it is a delusion that we want desperately to live with, because it is the glue that holds marriages together, that holds society together. So, yeah, there is romantic love is attachment. Oh, sorry, attraction. So we walk into, like I walked into a dance hall, I met Aileen and was like, wow, love at first sight, tingling, you know, endorphins going mad and unable to say anything, just staring and lost everything.
So fundamentally, the first part of it is the animal instinct,
basic animal instinct, refined over time, because there's a control of emotions and there isn't, you know, you just don't jump on top of somebody that you see and you want to mate with. So that, but it is a basic instinct that gets tingled or kind of emotionalized. And that attraction is fundamental to all societies, I think, right from the beginning of time. Now, property and power and money, you know, come into it and kind of took away from that romantic attraction. But it is the one that we keep on saying to ourselves is fundamental to our understanding of life and what it is to live a good life. Mm-hmm. And you say, yeah, when you find it, hold on to it. It's amazing. And so that we tell ourselves stories. I mean, I was looking it up. 47 million books were written on romance last year, so 2021. 47 million. And when you listen to songs on the radio, you know, 72% of them are about love. So we...
Okay, so it is the fundamental story of the human race right now. It's
absolutely. And you can love... yes, you can be attuned. The love between parents, between a mother and a child, and our if you like, brothers and sisters, our partners, then you are attuned to them. You know exactly where they're at, what their needs and interests are. You care about them. You love them. And then the final dimension, if you like, is attachment. Mm. You would be lost without them. And so when you lose your loved one, whether you become separated or whether they die, in my case, but there is a sense of loss. Now, that attachment that you have, it can be to everything and anything. I mean, it could be to God, Jesus, to Muhammad. Mm-hmm. It could be to, the Irish nation. You know, people are willing to go and die for a cause, as they're doing for all over trying. The world. And that attachment is enormous. And it's, as I said, I became attached to my dog.
Yeah, and we've talked about that before and we'll come back to it. Clelia, what does love mean to you?
I had a good think about this and I changed my answer. I think love is nourishment.
Okay.
I think it's like a basic, if you want to distill it down to its purest form. Love is that, like everything you've just been saying there, it's that thing that we're all looking for. And in the right doses with the right person, you feed and you thrive on it.
Yeah, okay.
If you love incorrectly, if you love too much or too little, it breaks you down as a person.
Wow, you're so right. There's a sweet spot there.
There's a sweet spot. Yeah, and it's every type of love. Because I was trying to think, romantic love, child love. You know, I love my dog, if anything happens. But you're right. Everything in the correct dosage and balance. For me, love is actually nourishment.
You're such a sensible person. Everything in the right balance.
But hard bit. That's trying
James,
to find that.
You've never been in love, have you?
I mean, platonically, Jesus, of course, love everyone.
You've loved me, bro.
I've loved
in
you.
Love, in love.
I haven't. I don't think so.
Like, really?
I've had, the odd fella here and there, but nothing ever of sustenance or anything of kind of note. So at the time, you might have thought, oh, I love them.
I was going to ask
in reflection,
you.
No.
Are you
God,
just saying that now in retrospect, just kind of so to send a message to that person?
I still don't believe that I was actually in love at all.
Do you miss it? I mean, it's like...
That's the thing, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, for me, it's one of the best highs.
Do you feel you've missed out?
Well, so far, yeah, I think so. And that is a kind of a
when
weird...
When everyone talks about it and everything, you think I've never known that, like...
Kind of, yeah. And I suppose, like, you know, it's like that when you're going to weddings and everything and you're so... Obviously, you love it so much and it's great and you're so happy for everyone else. But you're kind of going, well, I wouldn't mind that myself. So... fundamentally, I suppose I have never been
and
in
you,
love.
Is there you do you have a feeling that you might never be able to love as the time goes on that you're...
No,
kind of I have to break down the other panelists. Is that particular avenue of pleasure dead to you forever?
I'm worried.
Well, I'm much older than you are, and look where I've...
We'll come to everyone's stories then.
No, but I have faith. I do indeed, absolutely.
Don't mind Tom.
But the love of your life is out there. You just have to find him.
In fact, there are probably thousands of, and millions of loves of his life out there. I don't think there's only one for everybody. But
that's a very interesting one.
So Tom, you mentioned Aileen.
Yeah,
you guys met as teenagers, actually.
Well, yeah.
And teenage love doesn't always kind of, survive into adulthood.
No, I was 17 and 15, and she was 15. She was still at school. She was in fourth year. And I had run away to France. And I came back, and I went to a dance. I mean, imagine meeting somebody at a dance. And, it was the Saturday after Easter, and I had given up. I had to go back to France. And I turned around the corner and there was Aileen and I was absolutely overwhelmed.
Do you remember the moment?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, people, you know, talk about epiphanies, you know, like, well, I found God or I met somebody. That moment I met Aileen was like thunderstruck. Endorphins.
Based on physical attraction or was there something
physical
else?
Physical attraction, but her beguiling smile, I mean... Yeah, and then we had a dance, and it was the last, you know, this sounds so romantic, but it was the last dance, and I was desperately trying to make, because I was going back to France, and I didn't know what to say. I didn't want to say something clichéd. I didn't want to say, you know, like, do you come here often? Do you like to be buried with my parents or whatever? I said...
That went straight to there, didn't you?
And I just said, woof.
Yeah.
What? There was a silence.
Cool.
And then she said, meow.
I couldn't make that up, and in that you saw each other, you knew each other.
Clearly you were and Tom, so then that's all very hormones and everything, teenagers, we have very intense relationships and everything. Does that then mature into, as you grow up, does it mature into something else, or did you manage to keep that
intensity? Well, I was thinking about when Cleely was saying that, you said a year, you know, I mean, my goodness, if I could kept that moment alive for the rest of my life, you mean if I could live in that bliss, fantastic. Mm. But there is a prosaic nature to living relationships that involves, as you said, making the bed, doing the dishes, walking the dog, cooking, etc. And it's if you can still find love while you're doing all those mundane, prosaic things that occupy everyday life. And that's what the task is, because that's what I say is, it's easy to fall in love, absolutely, but it's damn difficult to make love on a daily basis, you know, to give, and you said about, you know, kind of, it's a nourishment, it is, but it's a balance between giving of yourself and then surrendering to the other and the other surrender. So you two become one and become so attuned and attached to each other that you are on the same wavelength and you know and feel and care for the other and the other knows and feels and cares for you.
So we do, so we have to give up a little bit of excitement, do we? That's okay.
No, I think what I think we have to try and rekindle it. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's feeding it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's feeding it.
Hit the nail on the head, like. Yeah.
So, Clelia, you didn't follow the traditional path then. So you started Fair City as a teenager.
I did.
How old were you then when you had Clarabelle?
I was 21 when I got pregnant, and I was 22 when I had Clarabelle.
And then, so does that make meeting someone or dating somebody difficult then for like a whole 10 years when you would be naturally meeting or dating or whatever?
Yeah, 100%. But my priorities changed. She became my focus. She became my relationship. And I didn't, just personally speaking, but I didn't want to jeopardize that by bringing in the wrong person. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
I didn't have the time to make a mistake. And it's about making mistakes, actually, that leads you. You were very lucky. You met your person and it happened beautifully in that moment. But I guarantee, in order to know the right person, you have to make the mistake with the wrong person.
Okay, and if you have a kid there, you have to be
there was just no way I was
breaking.
And I was also the breadwinner, so I had to focus my time on mm-hmm. paying the bills, paying the mortgage. Am I an artistic person? I have a mortgage. I had to keep working.
Mm. And was there an expectation, I don't know, family and stuff like that, that you should settle down and that you should
that was the greatest pressure. I was happily single, and a lot of my pals are happily single. Society wants you to be in a relationship. Society wants to match it off. Do you know what I mean? I have one pal whose mother, I won't mention any names, but at age 25, introduced her daughter as in, this is Mary. She's unmarried. She hasn't wed. When my sister got married, she was the younger one. I'm the oldest sister. My grandmother, God love her, got into a flap. I wasn't in the flap. And she'd ring me. She goes, Clelly, don't be worrying. There's a great fella out there waiting for you somewhere. And I got to a point where I said, well, thanks, Grandma, don't be worrying about me, I'm fine, don't be worried.
And you were fine.
I was fine.
But as you saw your friends settle down and life starts changing for them and everything, you didn't feel kind of left out or you didn't feel you'd like
honestly,
that?
Honestly, 100% I did. Of course you do. You feel, the biggest part of being in a relationship is being vulnerable. And the biggest part is saying to yourself, actually, I would like to meet somebody. I would like to put myself out there. I would like that. What you have, that was the kind of the romantic notion, and being able to say that, knowing what you want is really hard. Knowing what you don't want is easy.
Yeah, I think that's,
do you know what I mean?
A huge
change. So were you, I want to talk to Kelly for a minute. So were you lonely all those years, even though you had your other half,
of course, your
daughter, but it's not the same.
But being able to admit loneliness is one thing and not it turning into something else. Was I busy? 100%. Was I focused on that one person? Absolutely. But again, it's about balance. And it's about saying, actually, you know, I did get to a point where I'm going to go, right, I'm going to put myself out there.
And when was
I'm
that?
I'm going to get myself match fit.
When was that?
I'd say Clara was a teenager. She was 15, 16.
Okay, so
the year after the year of the gathering. So it would have been 2014.
Well,
but I was changing
that's
a lot
interesting how you time it. The year after,
well,
was it
you
the gathering
to
gave you the wake
up
call?
Point, right? I won't tell you what I called 2014 because it's not we're online. It might offend people. But yeah, 2014, I kind of went, right, I'm now, it's a bit of time for me now. And and it's the weird thing is about being slightly selfish, but sharing. You've got to know what you want.
Yeah. And
that was
so
my journey. This is not prescriptive for anybody
else. Yeah, I know that. Yeah. At that stage, then had the apps and everything had come in by then. It was a different scene.
Yeah, but
you
see, don't forget,
I'm
a bird of the 90s and the naughty noughties. So there was a kind of a shame or a you're not on the app, sorry. Like
I remember at the beginning.
And then
hold on
a minute, I was also your one out of Fair City, so I was running the risk of going on a date and someone saying to me, "So Niamh, right, that's it, knife and fork down. Thank you so much. Good luck. I'm out." Here. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not that Fair City stopped me, you know, having a romantic side to my life, but I was
people
already
had a bit of a preconceived notion.
People have a preconceived notion of who I, and I couldn't be further from that character in Fair City.
I would have
thrown Paul out years ago. I wouldn't have put up with that nonsense. Do you know what I mean? Like, so.
And are you on the apps, James? And like, is there a touch of what Clelly is talking about there for you as well? That like, it's James Patrice.
Yeah, sometimes. So I'd be on Tinder. I always say it's kind of the Sunday night fear. That's when Tinder's happen.
Really?
Oh yeah, people download because obviously they've been out Saturday night. They have ultimate fear. I'm alone. I've no one to hold me. Sunday
they've
night.
No one to watch TV with.
Literally, if you're looking for a fella, get on it on Sunday because everyone downloads it. And you can kind of tell because all the profiles are refreshed. New photos. Everyone's looking well. But I will be on them. And I mean, yeah, sometimes when you match, you might have people saying, oh, they'll message you saying, ah, James, that's not you. Is that really you? And then my little trick is, if I kind of, you know, think they're actually a bit of all right, sometimes they'll DM me on Instagram and they'll say, oh, hey, James, I think someone's catfishing you. Now, if I don't like them, I'll say, oh, typical. It's always happening.
Yeah.
Okay, so you pretended.
But then,
indeed, that wasn't
won't
me.
Be listening.
Yeah.
I'm still hungover. It's grand.
Okay.
But they might listen back. And then if I like them, I'll say, yes, actually, it is me. How are you? So it's kind of a bit advanced, but there always is that where they'll say, oh, James, how are you keeping? How are you getting that? And if they haven't my Instagram or whatever, they might have this, again, preconceived idea that I'm either always in glitter or I'm a 6'7" woman. You know what I mean? Like, depending on what day of the week it is. And so it can be hard. And then oftentimes, if I do end up meeting someone, I'm not saying not even romantically, but if I meet someone just out and about, they'll say, gosh, you're actually a lot maybe quieter in real life, or you're not really much like your Instagram. And I say, well, Instagram is a snippet of one day, you know what I mean? So it is that kind of balance where you're trying to find
Like being yourself is the hardest part, and seeing the person in front of you for exactly who they are, that's the hardest part of being in a relationship. Not projecting on top of them, not wishing them into something else. But like, I met Neil when I was my most self. It was during lockdown. I had roots. I could do a bit of a grooming. I was not match fit. And only Stephanie Prisner made me go out on the date because he had asked me out. And okay. I was kind of going,
Did you meet him IRL, bump into him in the real world kind of thing?
Myself, I know Neil since I was 4. He was the boy next door. And I remember him being the boy next door. I was madly in love with Neil when I was 4 and he was 5. We were at that bang bang. Shoot me down. And I always wondered what happened to him. My parents separated, so I moved away. So I always couldn't remember his last name. I used to say to my mother, what was the boy's name 2 doors up? And she goes, I can't, it was an unusual name, right? So I think he was a core memory for me. I remember having that. I remember he was formative to how I felt within, not in relationship, we were only kids, but he used to look after me. He used to... And we had the same height difference. So there was a lot of I recognised him.
He was your first experience of a friendship, essentially.
And Neil says this as well. It was our first experience of what love felt like. I didn't realise.
No.
Well, yeah, 100%. Like an affection. Does that make sense? A very blooming affection. Like, I mean,
how did you meet again then, and what happened?
So what happened was I grew up in Castleknock. We could have met loads of times during the years, by the way. It's weirder than that, actually. So my grandmother used to buy her handbags from Neil's mother in the Standard on South End Street. Her friend set up Neil's mother and father on a date.
Wow.
And then 20 years later, we buy a house 2 doors up.
The cosmos. Okay.
Weird. We're looking at you. So it was that point actually in the just before COVID was kicking off, and it was that sweet spot in COVID where people were kind of reaching out to people they hadn't seen in years and kind of were sending messages saying, I've got to check in with you, and always wondered what happened. So I literally got a message one day. I happened to have I'm never on Facebook, and he'd messaged saying, it's great to see you doing so well. I didn't know whatever you grew up to be. I wasn't buying any, but I was on the RT Guide to cover for every 6 months for 22 years. But he had moved away. He wasn't living in Ireland. So he didn't know me. And cool as a cucumber, playing it completely terribly, I texted back and I said, oh my God, I always wondered what happened to you. I was madly in love with you when I was 4.
Oh, wow.
Straight up there.
Yeah.
But, straight in. Yeah.
But I wasn't in a space where I wanted to be meeting somebody else or in a relationship. And I thought he was, you know, in a different space in his life. But we corresponded for about nearly a year, I'd say 6 months.
Before you met?
Yeah. Wow. 100%. Very gently. It was nothing, you know. And then he asked me for a coffee and I just went, I've just put on the COVID pounds. I've got roots down to my nose. I am not match fit. I'm not going on this date. And I would need to lose a half stone before I meet him. So Stephanie Prisner was saying to me, so you're going to go on a grapefruit diet before you meet him? Are you mad? It's the end of the world. You need to go out there and meet this man. So we did. We went for a walk in the Phoenix Park.
Come here. Is it... you know when you're, and I won't say older, but you know what I'm saying. You're more mature,
I'm wiser.
Right?
Yeah. I'm a wiser bride.
So when you meet someone at that point, is that a different kind of love? Like, I mean, like you look at Tom and the hormones as a teenager and everything. James, we're not sure yet. But are you kind of less naive and less kind of foolish about love and everything? Is it a bit more eyes wide open? Like, and even going into marriage then, like you see some young couples getting married and you're embarrassed for them.
My sister used to tell me, Clelly, don't worry, you're going to get a lovely fella on the second round offers.
Like what did she mean?
When all these fellas start getting divorced, you're going to get a lovely fella. Brilliant. Wasn't she right?
But she wasn't.
Wasn't she right?
Is that a strategy?
There's one thing you need to know about me. I have no strategy. I turn up when I'm not ready. I feel the fear. I literally have a pain in my chest most days. I have to really push myself to be out in the world. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I can see you're the shy, sensitive.
But I am so that sensitive kind of person.
So is it then a different thing going into new love at that stage? Like, is it a bit more grown up and a bit less kind of butterflies and stuff and a bit more practical?
No, 100% not. But yes, at the same time, I knew what I knew from being in and no disrespect to anybody else in my past, but being in the wrong relationship, I knew what I didn't want I knew the mistakes I didn't want to make. And actually, I went, after a relationship broke down, I went into therapy to make sure that I understood why I accepted certain things.
Yeah.
And I was determined not to make those mistakes again. Because we're living in a world now, it's very easy to, according to TikTok, everybody broke up with is a narcissist. That's not true. It takes two people to make a relationship. Right? Yeah, it takes two people to break up a relationship. And it goes back into what you're saying is every day, it's the little things. It's the little things that I love doing with Neil. We love going to do the shop together. Mm. Do you know what I mean? We love having to celebrate those little things. And they're the important things in life.
Yeah, yeah, that'll wear off. Tom.
It won't wear off. Come on. And I'm a cynic. But I refuse to let it wear off.
But remember that novelty of doing shopping together? You'd moved in and all that.
Yeah, but Tom, you need those.
So even if we come to terms with, okay, being able to enjoy the little things and being able to settle into, I think you said, that more prosaic kind of part of life, we keep the love alive. But then the big thing is that life happens, right? Massive challenges, ups and downs, all that kind of thing. And I think generally they either split a couple up or bring them closer together would be the thinking. Mm. Like when your son Luke died, he was a baby, was he?
Yeah, 10 months. Yeah.
And what does that do to love then?
Well, I think it's not only the scientific evidence is that couples either break up or they stay together. And if you, in the case of the stay together, it brings you together. So grief can you just withdraw into your own world. Mm. You can't talk about it. It's something so deep and personal that you just...
So that the two people go on their own path, their own individual path. And you and Aileen didn't do that.
No, and that's the ability to be able to talk. And I think that's what makes... if you like, love survive, is to be able to be honest and open about your fears, your anxieties, and to share them.
Be vulnerable.
And then when that one hit out of the blue, Thunderbolt, we made a decision very quickly that we would have another child as soon as possible. And yes, Alwyn was born almost 12 months later, or less than that. And that became a new focus.
Yeah.
And taking it away. And
then when Aileen got, she was sick for quite a while before she died.
Well, yeah.
Is that another kind of love again then, that phase of something?
Yeah, watching the love of your life die takes a lot of courage, forbearance and all that stuff. The thing is that you still live in hope. You still live in denial right up to the end.
Right, yeah.
And and then it is another. As much as falling in love is like falling off a cliff, etc. Likewise, when your loved one dies, there's no hope left. There's no. That's the end. And I think what it was that, like a lot of other people, I mean, how do you deal with this? And it took me ages and. To talk about it. That's how I became involved with Carol, in Sister, because she was the one who listened. She was a Samaritan. She was the one who listened to me and allowed me to grieve and allowed me to talk and then eventually to write and encouraged me to write about Aileen and to get it out there.
Does that blow up a family, the extended family, if you get together with your late wife's sister?
It is, but the what you fight for is love, because that is the one that you believe in. Mm-hmm. And yes, there is a process of adaptation. Yes, there is a process of coming to terms. And I wouldn't say there was an easy ride. I'm still very good friends with Donal, and we have a very good, warm family relationships. Not to say that it was a bit rocky at the beginning, but you do fight for it, mm-hmm. because you know that that's love is the most important thing in my life, and being in love is one of the most important things I can strive for. And yes, I will go out on a limb to attain.
So there might
that.
Be a price to pay, but okay. James, are your friends all starting to kind of settle down and couple up now. Is that hard?
Yeah, I only actually had this conversation with a friend of mine the other week. It was his birthday, and he was just kind of not feeling it really. I said, "You're all right," and he's singing as well. He said, "Yeah," he goes, and in fairness, the two of us always kind of, you know, I've always like don't let your loneliness or whatever it is. It should never dominate your life. So, for example,
are you lonely?
So I would acknowledge that sometimes, yes, you can be lonely purely because, and it was just my friend who said the same thing, on occasions like your birthday or something like that. It'd be nice to have
someone. Can I just preface this really carefully, right, from an older bird?
Clelia, yeah. Let James
know. I need to give this a word of warning, right? A boyfriend is not just for Christmas.
Oh, no, I know.
You could be stuck with them for the rest of your life. Yeah. Choose wisely, my friend.
I will.
But still, it is good to have somebody at Christmas.
It's just for those little occasions.
Don't be listening.
But then we kind of both acknowledged that it's... And it was the first time that the two of us had ever actually said, well, actually, yeah, it is kind of crap sometimes. Mm. And it was actually lovely to acknowledge it and address it and say, yes, there is loneliness there, but... And you know, not to let it consume your life though either, because there's so many other amazing things in life and, you know, work and friends and all that kind of stuff. But it was nice and actually refreshing to sit with someone and say, actually, it is a bit desperate sometimes,
and
isn't it?
Then, like, I would have thought, and this is me being a Georgie old man, that if you're at that point, you're in your 30s now.
34.
Yeah? 34. Yeah. And people are settling down and you're feeling a bit lonely. Are the apps a kind of slightly depressing place to be?
Oh, they're horrific. They're the misery of the... Oh, my God. And then the misery of a first date. And as you get older, you kind of think to yourself, you know, with the first date, it was kind of COVID that maybe kind of anti-date in a way, because I'm kind of saying, you realise how precious time is.
Yeah.
And when you go on a first date and you sit there, you know in the first 2 seconds whether it's going to be brutal or not. And then you think, I have to do 2 drinks minimum with this person.
Is it two drinks minimum?
You have to. It'd be rude not to otherwise.
See, we never dated my generation.
You have to get dressed up. You want to show off the outfit as well. So you do that, two drinks minimum, and then you go home and you think, I'm after wasting hours that I could have A, been out with my friends or been sitting watching Real Housewives. You know,
and Camille, would you be in situations where like the conversation just isn't happening kind of thing? What's a bad date like?
I mean, I've had many a date where, you know, the conversation has been fantastic, but there's no attraction, you know. And then you kind of, the single fear comes into you and you say, well, you know what? I'll give it another go. And you bully yourself into perhaps thinking that they're the one. They're not really.
So we're back to where we started with Tom. If you're not feeling the animal within,
straight away, totally.
Yeah,
and I suppose really.
In a way, it's
kind of gone against me going forward. Thinking of dating,
you just can't. You can, but you can convince yourself to be in a relationship. You can convince yourself, no, I'm going to try to make this work. But if it's a square peg in a round hole, and you usually know from day one.
Your first impressions.
Yeah, you know it.
Yeah, but I think that's what's changed.
You either fancy someone or not. Yeah,
so check.
We grew up.
Sorry to interrupt.
You haven't been sorry to interrupt up to now. Yeah. You're getting manners.
I will not be silenced.
That's what's changed is that there was a one size fitted all. We talk about the 1950s. That was what the case. Now it's exploded. There's all sorts of relationships. Mm. There's all sorts of attractions. There's all this talk about what am I getting out of this? And there's this new kind of society of individuals and individuals wanting to live the best life, to flourish, to nourish, etc. Mm. And then there's all these attractions. There's all this. I mean, what amazes me is that we were told when divorce came in that it was going to be the ruination of the Irish family. We have had the lowest divorce rate in Europe, one of the lowest in the world. And
it's been the making of my family, actually. There you go. That's a statistic.
What I'm saying is that the society in which I grew up in, you know, my friends, very few of them divorced. But were they happy? Well, that's the interesting thing, is that you are in a supportive network. Mm. Now, that network, that community in Ireland can be stifling. It can actually strangle you.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's very supportive. Mm. So that, you know, you are all in the same boat, so to speak, and you can be happy.
Yeah. Yeah. I said that when the gays were getting older, because any man I knew in the 90s were gay. I didn't know any single men. I thought you might as well be as miserable as the rest of us.
Well, I can't wait to get divorced one day. This would be great, wouldn't it? For the drama.
Okay. And that's
as good. Married first,
that's,
though.
Yeah, yeah. That's as good a point as any. And that's probably a better sociological point than Tom was just making there. You cut right to it there.
Yes.
Okay. James, you're in Panto?
I am, yes. Ollie Polly and the Magic Lamp in the Three Olympias. So, and I'm the genie. So maybe my lamp.
No. And Kelly, you've a podcast.
I have What the World Needs is another podcast dropping on Monday.
Actually, you gave me a sneak preview of it.
Oh, did you have
it's
a
good,
listen?
Yeah,
so it's basically good. What it is...
And I wouldn't often say that about a podcast.
Well, our unique twist is that it's me, John Gilday of Owens DDB, who's an advertising gent, and Dean Jones of Scimitar Sound, who is an engineer. And basically what we're doing every week is we get together and we make an ad. But we leave the mics open and allow the audiences in, so you can hear us making an ad and trying to make sense of our 40-year-old selves.
Yeah, no,
it's a comedy.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's funny.
Thank you.
Okay, Tom Inglis, Clelia Murphy, and James Patrice. Thank you all. We've loads of texts on this, but I want to vet them during the break, so I might read some afterwards. Guys, that was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.